Hello, Market Watcher. I'm David Revelle, and this is our weekly review for ValueSign.com. For all our podcasts, articles, references, and charts, visit ValueSign.com. Well, this week began with stunning news out of China. Their economy had dramatically slowed in the third quarter, completely unexpected. This news underscores some of the troubles that we're seeing out of China, where events like the missed bond payments by Evergrande leads one to believe that China is experiencing hard economic times right now. Next, we looked at the bond market and how different they see the financial world versus how stocks see it. And then we learned that a slowing economy may not be limited to China. The Atlanta Federal Reserve just lowered their fourth quarter estimate for the American growth rate to just 0.5%, far below that 6% growth we saw earlier in the year. And finally, on an upbeat note, Donald Trump launched his new social media company, Digital World Acquisitions, and it's one of the hottest new issues I ever recall. Just 2 days of the most frantic trading ever, and Trump's new company is worth an unbelievable $3 billion. Putting it in the top one-third of all publicly traded companies even before they open their doors. So sit back, grab a cup of your favorite beverage as we take a look back at the week just passed from ValueSide.com. Well, the big news overnight was the announcement of the latest economic growth rate for China. For 25 years, China has been the fastest growing, most consistent, large economy in the world. Put a line under their GDP chart, and you'll see that the Chinese economy has grown at 6% each and every year. That was until the lockdown year of 2020, when, like the rest of the world, the Chinese economy went into a sharp, but presumed short, year of contraction. Now, all of that was supposed to be behind us. Major economies worldwide are now recovering. And China, which after all is the manufacturing hub of the world, should also be recovering. But today's report on the Chinese economy shows that China's economy grew at less than 5% for the last 12 months. But it's worse than that, much worse. For the last 3 months, the Chinese economy grew at only 0.2%. Project that number forward, and you have a Chinese economy that's really not growing at all. That is basically stagnant. In other words, the Chinese economic recovery appears to be over. And what's more, Chinese industrial production is particularly weak, having come in at slightly over a 3% growth rate. This sets up something that we haven't seen since the 1980s, the chance that the American industrial production may exceed Chinese for the first time in over 40 years. Now, the U.S. industrial production number will be released at 9:15 this morning Eastern Time. And if Wall Street is correct, the U.S. should come in at a 5.7% increase in their industrial production. This exceeds Chinese by more than 2.5%. A remarkable divergence, and showing just how far off the mark the Chinese really are currently. Now, no matter how the Chinese try to spin these numbers, these results are stunning, and it shows a precipitous drop in the Chinese economic growth, the ramifications of which will be felt for quite some time. Well, we're living in a growing economic crisis, a crisis that we'll shortly see, if you haven't already, an emptying of store shelves, a tightening of vital supplies. We call this the supply chain issue. It's the inability of U.S. consumers to secure the goods and products they wish to purchase. I recently tried to order a piece of furniture. I was told it will be available in about 7 months. But when pressed, the store really wasn't sure if that would be available then. They just hoped it would. And I'm not alone in this. Thousands of Americans are finding the same. Items that we want to purchase just aren't available. And this problem grows more severe by the day. I estimate that by the end of the year, it's likely that our economy will be in a recession because of this supply chain. But like so many issues in this country right now, supply chain does little to help us understand just what the real problem is. It obscures rather than enlightens. It hides the real parties who are at fault, implying that somehow an amorphous transportation problem is at work, when the reality of where we are is much more sinister. And unfortunately, politicians of all stripes in this country have hidden and obscured this fact from the American public for years. I refer you to a January 2004 Federal Reserve paper entitled, "Is China, quote, exporting deflation?" This was a concept which had captured Wall Street and the financial markets, that what we were seeing in our economy was the beneficence of China, that through the wonderful goodwill of the Chinese Communist Party, they were exporting low-price goods to us. It was a gift, as if Santa now lived in Beijing. Americans were showered with low-price TVs, stereos, sneakers, and let's not forget iPhones. It was the best of all world, a consumer's paradise, the place where Americans continued to pay lower and lower prices, stretching those paychecks farther and farther. What could be better? At least, that's how it was portrayed on this side of the Pacific. "China's just exporting deflation, don't you know?" said Wall Street, and every political leader who walked up behind the podium. And it was easy for Americans to buy this line. Goods were really available, shelves were full, and just the prices were falling. Just because some of our friends who worked here in American factories were now out of work was no reason to stop this gravy train. Just because Walmart shelves were full of Chinese and foreign products wasn't bad. After all, the prices were low. It took the pandemic, and now the intervening transportation issues. Yes, there are indeed transportation chain issues here, but as I've pointed out before, it's the finished product chain and not the supply chain, but that's another story. Right about now, it's become apparent to nearly everyone that something is terribly wrong, that we are in the very precarious position of having many of the goods we need on a daily basis 1,000 miles away across the Pacific Ocean, that we've been played, that a very carefully orchestrated, long-term plan undercut our market prices and moved our manufacturing to China and other Asian nations. And that, my friends, is the real problem. It's not just a transportation issue, although at the moment that has to be the focus. The fundamental core to our problem is that the most technologically advanced, financially sophisticated country on the planet is no longer self-sufficient. We must rely on other nations to produce what we no longer can. We consume, but we don't produce. And unless and until we can turn that around, we will be at the whim of other countries, nations that likely don't have our best interest at heart. Our manufacturing plants were taken away from us. Until we focus on that reality, any so-called solution will be temporary. Yes, we must first solve the supply chain issue, but we must then immediately start to work on the manufacturing issue. Yesterday afternoon, we pointed out that the Atlanta branch of the Federal Reserve Bank, in their GDP Now model, is calling for economic growth this quarter of just 0.5%. Essentially, that's zero growth. This is the largest drop in economic projections that I ever recall. Just think back. On July 30 of this year, just 3.5 months ago, this same GDP model was looking at a 6% economic growth rate. This would have represented one of the best quarters of economic growth in recent memory, and roughly double our historic trend. But that's all gone now. What could have been, but is not going to be. Throw it in the dustbin. We're about as far away from that kind of rosy economic outlook as you can get. Obviously, whatever Washington and the Federal Reserve have been doing has not been enough to overcome external impacts from such negatives as the supply chain, continuing COVID lockdowns, and the threat of more lockdowns. As we've been saying for some time, this is a sick economy, and if the Atlanta Fed's model is on the money, it's about to get a lot sicker. So if you accept our premise that the economy is weakening dramatically, then let's take a brief overview of just what the Fed and the President have in mind for our anemic economy. First up, coming in just 13 days, will be the next meeting of the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee. By all indications, the Fed's objective will be to begin a tapering process, where their formerly stimulative monetary policy will be reversed. If it follows through on these recent speeches, the Fed will now begin to tighten, first by reducing quantitative easing, that is, reducing their monthly bond purchases, and then by raising interest rates. Tightening in the face of this slower economy. That doesn't look too good. Turning to the President and his current proposals, first up, the President wants to raise corporate taxes by 5.5%, to raise individual tax rates up to 39.6% max, and add a global corporate tax rate of 15% for certain multinationals. This would be by far the greatest new tax burden in memory, taking money away from the productive private sector at just the time they need it the most. And it doesn't stop there. Remember all that stimulus that flowed so fast and easy earlier in this year? Well, the bill for that is now coming due. New bonds will be floated to support this incredible new federal debt which has been created. This, too, will take funds away from the private sector, as the government is always the first in line to take funds at the capital markets. New regulation, such as that CARB emission requirements we were talking about for drayage trucks, will also drive the cost of doing business higher, just at a time when it's least needed. Overall, this is an administration that is rapidly operating on the wrong foot, tightening monetary policy, raising taxes and regulations at exactly the time this economy is slowing and likely going into recession. Unfortunately, we've seen all this before. Bad government policies enacted at just the wrong time, sending an economy into a tailspin. Smoot-Hawley and the tightening of trade helped precipitate the Great Depression. Nixon's wage and price controls contributed to the very deep recession back in 1974 and 75. In each case, it was the government's tin ear, their inability to gauge just exactly where the economy stood, that caused them to institute policies that made matters much, much worse. And I'm afraid that this president has inherited Washington's tin ear. The result of this administration's policies are to tighten at just the moment they need to be supportive, to tax and regulate at just the moment that business needs help just to survive. When recently we were warned by the president that it's likely to be a long winter, I'm afraid he might be right, made all the more so by his administration's policies. Well, he's the guy who comes to the company party, sits in the corner drinking his Dubonnet, and adding up the bar tab. In finance, he's the bond market. There's a good reason, after all, that the late Louis Rukeyser called them the bond ghouls. They're the ones who always have a dour look, and they measure the markets in basis points. There's one other bad thing that I can say about the bond market. Most unfortunately, they're often right. So let's take a look back at yesterday. It was a day of celebration for Wall Street. New highs for the Dow and Standard & Poor's 500. New highs for Bitcoin after the first crypto exchange-traded fund was launched this week. But there was one group that wasn't dancing for joy, and you guessed it, it was those bond people. In fact, far from dancing, bonds actually had by one measure one of the worst days they've had in some time. And that was the Treasury's auction of 20-year U.S. Treasury bonds. Now, before I go any further, I'm going to tell you that I'm going to round off all these yields so as not to totally confuse anyone listening. For the exact, down to the basis point yield, I refer you to the U.S. Treasury's website, Treasury Direct. Okay. Now, while the Treasury does auction bonds very often, some weeks every other day, they don't auction every maturity every day. In fact, it's a very complex process that they use to model out just what maturity bonds they want to offer at any given time. Managing the weighted average maturity of the U.S. Treasury's bond portfolio has to be one of the most formidable tasks that I can imagine. So that's a long way to say that these particular bonds, the U.S. Treasury 20-year bond, was last auctioned, it appears to me, in January. And all the bonds were sold back then at a yield of 1.6% rounded off. That was considered a very good yield at the time, and both Treasury and bond buyers went away happy. Flash forward now to yesterday, just 9 months later. Same bonds, the 20-year maturity. Only yesterday, Treasury had a very difficult time selling bonds at a yield slightly higher than 2.25%. I say difficult time selling the bonds because the dealers noted that there was a long tail to the offering. That's dealer speak for we had to beat the bushes to get them all sold. That is a 40% increase in the effective yield for these bonds, and remember, it's just 9 months later. Something that's almost impossible to fathom in a market where a big move is 5 basis points, or 0.5%. So what's this all mean? First of all, it's saying that U.S. Treasury bond auction buyers, the primary dealers and major institutions that actually take part in the auction, now see higher inflation baked into our future. And their actions, just in themselves, are raising the basic cost of capital throughout our financial system. Forget the Fed. This group is even more influential, especially when it comes to the mid and long-term interest rates. The other thing it means is that the cost of financing for the federal government just got 40% more expensive, even if the Fed's total debt remained the same. But of course, it did not remain the same. We had huge increases because of the pandemic and the stimulus programs put in place. And remember, President Biden's budget is likely to pile on to the existing U.S. debt. When you think of all these ramifications and the amount of money that will need to be spent at these higher interest rates, it's no wonder that those bond traders weren't dancing yesterday. By the way, pass the Dubonnet. Well, it had been rumored for months. Yesterday was the day that the real estate mogul, reality TV host, and the 45th president of the United States became Donald Trump, social media entrepreneur. For millions, this was a moment that they had hoped for, since Jack Dorsey and the management team at Twitter had censored him. It was the day that a little-noticed special acquisition company named Digital World Acquisitions became the most actively traded stock on NASDAQ, as literally millions poured into the stock that was to become the center of the new Trump media empire. The stock itself rose by fivefold, from an overnight close of less than $10 per share, hitting a high of over $50 per share yesterday. And if I'm right, we're going to see the same kind of performance today, as word about this new social media company reaches even more investors. Now, this demand is a clear indication of the need for more diverse voices in social media, a sector which, up to now, has sung from the same hymnal. There have been only a handful of social sites which have dominated the space, and all of which share the same political and social perspective. Their willingness to silence even a U.S. president was witness to the fact that they did not recognize free speech as a fundamental value. Rather than open up their platforms to free and open debate, the current group chose to steer public opinion in the direction that they wished to see prevail. Now, yesterday was the opening salvo that challenges that basic premise. Others have tried, but lacked the financial staying power to really challenge the reigning leaders in this industry, Google, Facebook, and Twitter. With this kind of public support, it now looks like a real viable challenger has arisen, one that will be ready and willing to take up the other side of the debate. For Trump, this moment has to be sweet, to challenge those who were thought to be unassailable, companies whose position was second to none, who had such a head start in infrastructure, experience, and capital. Remember, these existing social media companies are among the highest capitalized companies in the world, a couple of which have over $1 trillion in market cap. But we've seen great commercial empires before, and we've seen them come and we've seen them go. It's the nature of our free market system. Don't let the crown rest too long on any one company. I remember flying one day out of LaGuardia Airport in New York. It was shortly after another, formerly unassailable company, Eastern Airlines, had just declared bankruptcy. Of all their routes, only one was considered really profitable, and that was the New York-Washington-Boston shuttle. Thousands had come to rely on this quick and easy way to get between these major East Coast cities every day. For many, it was the major link in their business routine. Well, to make a long story short, a brash young New Yorker decided that he could take over the shuttle and make some money while continuing to provide a vital service to Northeast businesses. Now, I was flying just the day after the news that Eastern was gone. And there, on the runway next to me, emblazoned with the Trump logo, was the newest of the new Trump shuttle planes, painted, polished, and raring to go. How'd he do that, I wonder? In just 24 hours, he had the Trump shuttle up and running, on time, I might add, something that Eastern was never able to achieve. I learned right then never to underestimate this man. He seems to do the impossible and to challenge the unbeatable. I wouldn't bet against him this time, either. And that's The Value Side for Friday, October 22. I'm David Revelle. Please join me in praying that our country may get back to work.